this community radio station, broadcasting to you since 1922.
Welcome to Close Reads. Today, we have Belladonna, written and performed by Kaya Mongrain.
Oh, thou art encompassing, goddess. The gentle dips and rounded curves, the sharp divots and peaking arches became known to my sorry, wandering hands. Pillars of supple, freckled skin kissed delicately by sunlight, draped in white silk. Heavy cream and honeyed wine on parted, darkened, sanguine lips. You tasted mine, and found them to be the same sticky sweet. Oh, thou art blameless, goddess. So rapidly did my heart, beating and bare, fall to your feet, plucked with bloodied, raw fingertips, you feasted on the threads that remained. The pungent smell of raw flesh blooming scarlet, sliced free, covered in my viscera the color of ripened pomegranate seeds, slipped into my mouth the iron and salt, slicked my vocal cords heavy with yellow, thickened phlegm. Oh, thou art noble, goddess. Slithered into my stomach, twisted and tangled into a place for you to rest. My entrails a menagerie of shapes woven into rope for you to climb. My kidneys sponges for your love to scrub clean. Oh, thou art kindness, goddess. In the ebb of your calm flowing life into dreams, I find it sweet enough to rot the teeth still caught in my jaw. Oh, thou art merciful, goddess. The foaming Belladonna spit upon parted lips slipped carefully into the gift of the vine. Oh, thou art love, goddess.
Sometimes see that only a You're listening to Close Reads on CFRC 101.9 FM.
I'm Corey.
And I'm Madeline. On Close Reads, we share and analyze creative writing by students here at Queens. Tune in for Close Reads from close by.
Today, we'll be talking about Belladonna by Kaya Mongrain, which you just heard, followed by Abby by Mitski, which was actually one of the songs Kaya listened to while writing this piece. Belladonna was published in Quilt, Volume 4, Lost and Found.
Kaya Mongrain is an Indigenous Anishinaabe artist, writer, and fancy shawl dancer coming from her home community of Temagami First Nation. She is currently in her fourth year of concurrent education at Queen's University with a major in biology and minor in history. Her writings have been published in Quilt and Theatre Folk, with her art being on display in her home reserve and Union Gallery.
So I know I talked about the full body imagery sense last week with the cyclone, but Belladonna does this really well too, so I'm going to go right back to imagery. Especially in the first two stanzas, we hit on every sense. It opens, "Oh, thou art encompassing goddess," and the stanzas that follow do encompass all of the senses. Visually, we get the gentle dips and rounded curves and so on. There's so much visual imagery, so I'll leave that there to focus on the other senses. But the curves and then divots and arches move into tactile imagery as they become known to sorry, wandering hands. Next, we have taste with heavy cream and honeyed wine, followed by the speaker's lips as the same sticky sweet. We get a hint of sound as the heart falls, beating and bare, and tactile again with the raw fingertips. Back to taste with the feasting, visual with the viscera the color of pomegranate seeds, and back to taste again with iron and salt, and to taste and touch with the heavy, thickened phlegm. And we get a bit of sound imagery there too with them, or I guess the sound effects creating this imagery as heavy, thickened phlegm. Those two last words feel kind of thick and heavy, really, and this happens throughout the poem, but I'm not going to linger on it too long for time. But listening to and saying out loud the poem really shows how those words, like the sounds in them, reflect the content in really interesting ways as well. But I'm going to go back to focusing on the imagery in the text. The imagery thins out a bit after those first two stanzas, with mostly tactile in the third stanza, with the twisted and tangled organs, the entrails woven into rope for the goddess to climb, and the scrubbing of the kidneys. And then the two penultimate stanzas return to taste, with the sweetness and foaming spit. I think this full body imagery really grounds the poem in the body, and the combination of the sexual themes and the body imagery really ties in the sense of poisoning in super interesting ways. I think it brings to the surface the idea of poisoning as something very intimate, and the vivid descriptions here make you very aware of that intimacy and that sort of deep infiltration as you think about these parts of your own body while listening or while reading. The images also progress by body part, from the hands to the lips and mouth, to the throat and vocal cords, to the stomach and entrails more broadly, and to the kidneys, giving a sort of real-time play-by-play of the poisoning. As a result, the vivid five-sense imagery and the gradual progression really work in tandem to get the reader to experience the poisoning along with the speaker.
I'd like to touch on the shifting relationship between the speaker and the addressee, called the goddess, throughout the poem. In the first stanza, the goddess is figured as a person with a physical body, which we encounter through the speaker's touch. The gentle dips and rounded curves, the sharp divots and peaking arches become known to my sorry wandering hands. So we encounter the goddess through the form of her body, specifically the form as it's felt by and encountered as a sensory experience by the speaker. However, there's also a reciprocity in this relationship. The speaker says, "You tasted mine and found them to be the same sticky sweet." The speaker and the goddess are two lovers, encountering each other's bodies as a lush sensory experience. And this mutual encounter draws similarities between the two of them, even though the imagery focuses itself devotionally on the goddess's body. In the second stanza, the speaker and the goddess move from mutual lovers to a different form of reciprocity. Their proximity first undoes the speaker's own discreet body. They say, "So rapidly did my heart beating and bare fall to your feet. Plucked with bloodied raw fingertips, you feasted on the threads that remained." The speaker's body begins to break apart, moving from discreet person and lover to materials. And the sticky, messy quality of the imagery here indicates this is by no means a clean transition. The pungent smell of raw flesh, the viscera and the yellow thickened phlegm, these all tell us that the move from person to material is an involved one. And once material, the speaker can be consumed, but this leads to a breakdown of the goddess's form as well. Something is slipped into my mouth, something which we first assumed to be the speaker's own heart. But in the third stanza, it's revealed to be the goddess who slithered into my stomach, twisted and tangled into a place for you to rest. The goddess goes from consumer to consumed, entering the speaker's body as material and sustenance, but also with some semblance of a physical human form, once again communicated through its interaction with the speaker. The stomach's twisted and tangled into a place for you to rest the entrails, a menagerie of shapes woven into rope for you to climb. Whereas in the first stanza we encounter the goddess's outer form through the speaker's tactile experience, here the inside of the speaker's body is delineated through the goddess's tactile presence. Finally, the goddess shifts from solid to liquid. The foaming Belladonna, spit upon parted lips, slipped carefully into the gift of the vine. She is both the lover from the first stanza, whose kiss delivers the sticky sweet poison, and the poison itself bubbling up onto the speaker's lips in a second kiss. This final breakdown of physical form, altogether, comes interestingly with a callback to an action that necessitated the earlier physical form, emphasizing the fluidity that this relationship necessitates. The goddess moves from the vine to the gift of the vine, and her shifting form demonstrates the shifting nature of the love that she embodies for the speaker.
Next, we'll be playing Strange Kicks by Then Comes Silence, followed by an interview with Kaya. All right, now I am here with Kaya herself. Hello, Kaya.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us again.
Yeah, glad to be back.
So I wanted to ask you first if you could talk again about the title for a little bit and the inspiration behind the poem. What got us to Belladonna and the poem that we heard here today?
Yeah, for sure. So Belladonna originally was an extremely different poem, actually. It was a poem that I wrote a couple of years ago called The Goddess of Rot with the theming was very, very similar, but the structure and language was quite different. So
The themes of worship, extreme worship in some cases, has always been interesting to me and has a lot of room to explore what that could mean in many different ways. So I rewrote the poem Goddess of Rot because I felt like it didn't encapsulate how the object of worship, in this case, the goddess, was impacting the individual in the poem.
Okay.
So I really wanted to put in a new point of view on like the impacts on the perspective of the person involving the poem, like how the goddess's influence over them has really like impacted them physically and has kind of like manifested in the body. And yeah, so that's where like kind of like the name comes from, if that makes any sense. Belladonna was the name I came up with after I rewritten the poem and took a look at it and been like, well, what should this new piece be called? Because Goddess of Rot didn't really seem to fit, especially since the original poem had a lot to do with rotting and the process of decomposition. I felt like the new poem just didn't seem to fit that title. So I was playing around with some ideas here and there. And then as a biologist, I love looking into like plants and everything. It's like an area of study, I suppose, especially in biology, which will come up later. But belladonna is an extremely like poisonous plant. It's another name for like nightshade and everything like that. But the name itself means beautiful woman in Italian. So I thought it was very fitting, especially since there's so many themes of like poisoning in the poem. So I felt like when I heard the name and when I heard that title, I was like, oh, that's it. I found the title.
Yeah.
It just takes a while sometimes and usually has to wait until after a piece is finished. But yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. I remember when when you explained to me, when I was helping for context for everyone listening, I was one of the people editing this piece when we were going through the editorial process with Quilt. And I remember that kind of like opened up a whole other set of meanings to me once I knew that it was a poison. And it was just a really cool recontextualization that I felt like came from the title. I think the language in this piece is also really interesting. The kind of archaic language we only really get in the "Oh, thou art" lines, which open the stanzas. And then we shift to more modern language, even like shifting to from "thou" to "you" in the stanzas. Can you talk a little bit more about the language in the piece and the way it shifts in different parts of the poem?
Yeah, of course. So I guess like, yeah, to answer like the main broad question, the archaic language at the start of each stanza is meant to like relate to those ideas of blind praise and blind worship about considering without considering deeper implications. It isn't maintained throughout the stanzas, as I felt like the initial archaic language or the first lines is like a statement of sorts, followed by like a rationale of sorts in the rest of the lines. And I really wanted to highlight the ideas of to mimic like worship, like praise and all that sort of thing. And kind of the lines after that is kind of rationalizing that initial praise, right? So yeah, I think that's basically what it was for the most part. The language throughout the entirety of the poem was very intentional in the way that I did it. I really wanted to allow the reader and listener, if you're listening audibly through audio and stuff like that, I wanted the listener to really taste what was going on, feel what's going on through the senses. And senses are always important, and that, of course, leads into our third question, but I'll save most of that analysis for later.
Yeah.
But sense is always such a big, important thing, especially when it comes in poetry, since, you know, we all, for the most part, all of us, for the most part, can relate to those senses. For the most part, there are others and some that do not, which is, you know, fine in and of itself. It's just, for the most part, everyone has a body and does experience things in them. So I think that's very connective.
Yeah, I think that also that kind of idea of like this big idea at the beginning that is sort of like really lofty and then getting more into like the really grounded things that become more relatable with the imagery. I think that's a really interesting shift that you have there. As you kind of alluded to, our next question is about the body. As you know, as an illustrator on Quilt this year.
Yes.
Quilt's theme for this term is the body.
Mm-hmm.
And as we started working on the volume, I kind of found myself thinking a lot about this piece because there are so many really interesting things happening with the body here.
Yeah.
So I was kind of thinking back to this as just as we've been working on the volume. And then, of course, you have other poems about the body that I've also loved. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how you find yourself thinking when you write the body? Like, how do you approach it?
Yeah, so when I write about the body, I always see the inner workings of the body. So how, like, various systems interact to build what we can call a body, really. And that usually, that background usually comes from my biology studies. I'm a fourth year biology student. And you learn a fair amount about the workings of the human body and animal bodies and everything like that. And how those various biological systems interact to maintain the body and keep function going. So I find it fascinating, and especially when things go wrong, let's say. Yeah. A bit morbid, but you get what I mean. And the processes, like even in biology, you learn about how poisons interact with the body and how that influences all your metabolic systems and what it specifically targets. So that's usually kind of like my main inspiration when I draw when talking about topics involving the body. And the biggest thing that I really think about when I'm writing about the body is that body function is something that really connects all humans together.
Mm.
I think you only get one body for like the rest of your life. And we all have one. So, of course, different bodies do things differently and differences are what make them unique. But there is that understanding that when I write about, you know, blood, people know what I'm talking about. People know what color it is. And all that sort of thing. Or when I write about when someone is poisoned, and most people know that what, like, they can imagine what the discomfort must be like, the pain,
yeah.
The feelings surrounding that. It's that connection to others' bodily pain, almost like similar to like empathy. You feel empathy for their pain, that I think about in some of those instances when writing. And keeping him, of course, well, you also have to keep in mind not to make it too visceral for the sake of it, but to really try and elicit a bodily response. I think that's very powerful when you draw on the senses, for sure.
Yeah, I think you really kind of walk that line in a really effective way in this poem, because I think just the specificity of the body parts helps forward that discomfort. Like, you don't even need to say specifically what's happening with them, but the fact that you're locating it lets you feel them, and I think that is a really effective way to balance it.
It's usually not something that you sometimes think about, right? Mm-hmm. Where, like, you don't really, like, sometimes when you're going about your day-to-day life, you don't really think about where your kidneys sit, or where what your stomach is doing, or where it's sitting, or your intestines. You have them. It's just less acknowledged on where they are, sit in your body sometimes, and the location where they are. You know?
Yeah, definitely. That's all the questions we have for today, but thank you so much for coming in and for sharing your work with us again.
Thank you. I'm always glad to be back.
You have lots of amazing writing, so I'm sure we will have you back.
Yay!
You can read Belladonna by Kaya Mongrain on Quilt's issue. This has been Close Reads with Corey and Madeline on CFRC 101.9 FM. To take us out, we'll have Candyman by Flyanna Boss. He my little sweetheart, little gumdrop. He keep it gushy, gushy, and it won't stop. He my little nutter butter, I call him lollipop. I lick his lappy taffy, yeah, and then we swap. He my little sweetheart, little gumdrop. He keep it gushy, gushy, and it won't stop. He my little playboy, I'm dripping honeydew. I got a sugar brush when he come through. Make my cookie crumble, hope he don't fumble. I like that he could brag, but he still on the humble. My mountains and we take a tumble. Tasting my Skittles, I'm quick and he's nimble. He my little sweetheart, my sugar daddy. Put the cream in my coffee just to keep me happy. Twinks me side by side, never switch right or die. That's my honey punch, my sugar pie. He my little sweetheart, little gumdrop. He keep it gushy, gushy, and it won't stop. He my little nutter butter, I call him lollipop. I lick his lappy taffy, yeah, and then we swap. Keep it gushy, gushy, and it won't stop. He my little playboy, I'm
like a Reese's. I call him my grub hubby, he gon' feed me. He my little sweetheart, little gon' drive. He keep it gushy, gushy, and it won't stop. He my little nutter butter, I call him lollipop. I lick his lappy taffy, yeah, and then we swap. He my little sweetheart, little gon' drive. He keep it gushy, gushy, and it won't stop. He my little playboy, I'm drippin' honeydew. I got a sugar brush when he come through. Candyman.
Is a literary publication for and by undergraduate students here at Queens.
If you're interested in the fantastic minds of your peers, check us out on Instagram at QUQuilt to read our volumes of creative and academic writing.
Stay tuned for more information about our upcoming launch event.
Love, Quilt.
I should unwalk out the door, drag my feet along the floor. Then I see you, you're walking across the campus, co-professor studying romances. How am I supposed to pretend?
Help CFRC serve our community listeners, have your voice heard, and share your thoughts through our online listenership survey. Visit CFRC.ca, click on the link, and take the 3 to 4 minute survey. All participants can enter for a chance to win great prizes from Smoke's Poutinerie and Uber Eats. Your voice matters. Make it heard by taking the CFRC listenership survey today via CFRC.ca. Thank you for your support. CFRC 101.9 FM has launched its annual funding drive to raise $25,000 to support station operations, news and creative programming, and upgrades to our recording and performance studios. You can make a difference. Visit CFRC.ca right now and make your gift. Get a tax receipt through Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. More information at CFRC.ca. Thank you for your support. CFRC 101.9 FM has launched its annual funding drive to raise $25,000 to support station operations, news and creative programming, and upgrades to our recording and performance studios. You can make a difference. Visit CFRC.ca right now and make your gift. Get a tax receipt through Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. More information at CFRC.ca. Thank you for your support.
We are kicked by police. We have no employment rights. We can be put in jail for holding hands with your lovers in practically half the states of the United States. And the only way that that is going to end is for us to get into the streets.
We can't march up Main Street without jeopardizing our jobs, our homes, custody of our children, etc. We can march in solidarity in Washington.
What disturbed me was to pick up a Washington Post and see 25,000 and listen to the local news that said 125,000. I think we have to teach straight people how to count.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Daniel Lucias. Poland's government proposes a civil unions compromise, Saskatchewan lawmakers okay outing trans kids, and sounding off at the first queer march on Washington. Those stories and more this week because you found This Way Out.
I'm Melanie Keller.
And I'm David Hunt.
With NewsWrap. A summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending October 26, 2024. Poland's coalition government is introducing civil unions legislation. The proposed measure is for both same-gender and heterosexual couples, giving them joint inheritance rights and medical decision authority. They will also have the option to create either a shared property arrangement or a separation of property with equalization. Equality Minister Katarzyna Kotula called the bill's introduction a new chapter in the long march for equality, which, thanks to the many years of work of many LGBT organizations in civil society, has led us to this historic moment. Kotula can personally thank LGBT activists because a civil union would make her own informal male partner entitled to participate in raising their daughter living with them. However, couples in civil unions will not be able to jointly adopt, and a partner cannot adopt the biological children of their spouse. The adoption ban was apparently necessary to win the approval of one of Prime Minister Donald Tusk's three coalition government partners, the Poland Peasants Party. Tusk had vowed to move civil union legislation within his first 100 days in office. However, the messy transition of power from the far-right Law and Justice Party last year led him to form a three-party coalition government with more socially conservative factions. They were not comfortable expanding the rights of gender and sexual minorities. Neither was the Roman Catholic Church, a powerful political presence in the Eastern European country. Law and Justice had a stranglehold on Polish life for 8 years and used homophobia and transphobia to stoke fears of the other. The party also ignored rulings by the European Court of Human Rights, calling for the legal recognition of gay and lesbian couples. Now in the minority, Law and Justice and the equally conservative Confederation Party are likely to oppose the civil union bill in spite of the concession on adoption. The legislation will now be discussed among government ministries and be open for a public consultation period before being debated in Parliament. If it gets parliamentary approval, Law and Justice ally Polish President Andrzej Duda would also need to sign the measure. He has yet to take a public position on civil unions. In the background, all of the country's political parties are jockeying to influence the choice of his successor as his term expires in May of 2025.
The Parliament of Saskatchewan has voted to require parental consent when a student requests that their preferred name, gender identity, and/or gender expression to be used at school. This Parents' Bill of Rights has faced a court's temporary injunction, but Premier Scott Moe's government used the notwithstanding clause to push it through Parliament on October 18th. The notwithstanding clause allows the government to disregard the court and Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms. The new legislation establishes a parent or legal guardian's right to be the primary decision maker in their child's education. Opposition leader Carla Beck of the Progressive New Democrats condemned the measure, calling it a backward step in the history of Saskatchewan politics. Students in the provincial capital of Regina and in other cities took a forward step and staged a walkout/protest. Saskatchewan's Human Rights Commissioner, Heather Kitaj, resigned over the legislation. To her, the Parents' Bill of Rights is an attack on the rights of trans, non-binary, and gender-diverse children. Her resignation letter declared, "My husband and I have a kid who is trans." Premier Mo is promising that banning so-called biological boys from sharing changing rooms with biological girls would top the Saskatchewan Party's agenda if he wins re-election on October 28th.
The vast majority of transgender and non-binary young people receiving hormone therapies and puberty blockers are satisfied with their gender-affirming health care. This according to a study published this week in JAMA Pediatrics. In fact, 97% said that they were highly satisfied with the care they were getting. The study began in 2013 with 317 young people aged 12 or older in the U.S. and Canada. They were each followed closely for the next decade with regular one-on-one interviews. When parents were also surveyed, their responses tended to match those of their children. Some 270 respondents remained through 2023. Only 4% of respondents who were polled 6 to 10 years after transitioning expressed any regrets. The exact nature of their dissatisfaction was not specified, and not all of them decided to discontinue transitioning because of it. By comparison, 47% of people who have breast augmentation surgery reportedly express regret. The respondents were predominantly white and wealthy. Lead study author Christina Olson acknowledged the less-than-diverse sample. The Princeton University psychology professor blamed inequities in the availability of gender-affirming healthcare across the country. Virtually every medical and mental health association in the United States has expressed strong support for the types of pediatric gender-affirming healthcare examined by the study. It's not the first. JAMA Pediatrics had already published an Australian study that found only 4% of trans youth deciding to detransition. The findings rebuke critics of pediatric gender-affirming healthcare. They claim there's a much higher rate of regret, or that such reversible treatment can lead to actual physical or mental health problems. That was the conclusion of the controversial UK study called the CAS Report. It's been used to restrict access to gender-affirming healthcare in England, Scotland, and Wales for trans young people, and even for some adults. The same challenged hypotheses are the basis for oppressive legislation targeting transgender young people in more than 24 Republican-controlled U.S. states. The Supreme Court will hear a challenge to Tennessee's ban on pediatric gender-affirming health care in early December.
Finally,
he murdered a father of three, sentenced to life in prison. Kamala Harris pushed to use tax dollars to pay for his sex change.
The New York Times counts more than $65 million spent on ads like that one by Republican candidates for office, including presidential nominee Donald Trump. The waning days of the current campaign are deriding Vice President and Democratic nominee Kamala Harris's support for transgender rights.
I made sure that they changed the policy so that every transgender inmate would have access.
It sounds insane because it is insane.
It sounds highly edited because it is highly edited. This Trump ad is airing incessantly during sporting events. It goes on to accuse Harris of being first to enforce a legal interpretation that was actually in place during the former president's term. The political action committee, the Lincoln Project, produced a rebuttal ad.
Taxpayer-funded sex changes for prisoners and illegal aliens is a Trump administration policy. He's attacking Kamala Harris for his own record, and he thinks you're too dumb to get it.
The Lincoln Project was formed by a group of prominent anti-Trump Republicans, known for their tit-for-tat comebacks to their adversary. A play on pronouns was the obvious result of this folly.
Kamala's agenda is they-them, not you.
Trump is for he-him. Kamala is for us.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending October 26th, 2024. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Melanie Keller. Stay healthy.
And I'm David Hunt. Stay safe.
Hi, this is Margaret Cho, and you are listening to This Way Out.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
There's a reason why October is LGBTQ History Month. The community historically laid claim to it with a 1979 event in the U.S. Capitol.
The first time I came to Washington, my family and I couldn't eat ice cream in a drugstore here because we were black. Since then, I have come to Washington many times to demonstrate and to testify to different aspects of myself and my beliefs. The struggle of lesbians and gay men is a real and particular and inseparable part of the struggle of all oppressed people within this country.
You know us, America. We have worked with you in Memphis. We have marched with you in Selma. We have marched with you and been with you in Boston. We have been clubbed with you in Chicago and jailed with you in Birmingham and Three Mile Island.
It was important to me to be a part of our march on Washington.
The days are over when we were afraid. You see gay people all around here are not afraid of having their pictures taken 5 years ago. Well, you couldn't have got a group like this out even 5 years ago.
Thousands of people were on hand at Logan Airport to hear the Pope's first words in America.
America, America.
And here comes the National March on Washington for lesbian gay rights.
Just 10 years after Stonewall, and long before the age of acronyms, the massive October 1979 march and rally for LGBTQ rights surpassed all expectations, for good and for ill. Nothing had ever pulled the broad spectrum of the queer community together before, and the powerful national political organizations of today have their roots there. The network it established prepared the community to unite to confront the HIV/AIDS epidemic to come. It was also long before the internet, and building a network happened by word of mouth, in little trickles, not rushing streams of information. As recorded in a 1979 documentary by Lucia Chappelle and Greg Gordon, the first trickle for the march began during St. Paul, Minnesota's fight to defend their inclusive civil rights ordinance with lesbian comic activist Robin Tyler.
I was doing a benefit in St. Paul when they had the referendum there, and I made a joke. I think we should march in Washington. We'll set up tents. We know how gay men love camping. Well, it got such a huge applause, I think we should march on Washington, that I said, well, I'm not going to do the rest of the joke. It's got this applause. So they formed the Minnesota Committee for the March on Washington, and then Harvey picked it up in San Francisco.
I call for that march on the day of freedom in Washington, D.C., on the same spot where over a decade ago, Dr. Martin Luther King said, I have a dream that is fading.
We cannot have people come to this country on visas. We are kicked by police. We have no employment rights. You can be put in jail for holding hands with your lovers in practically half the states of the United States. And it is time for this to end. And the only way that that is going to end is for us to get into the streets.
The idea for a national lesbian gay demonstration in the nation's capital was discussed from coast to coast. And in February 1979, a national conference to discuss the feasibility of such a march was held in Philadelphia.
We need to march on Washington. I don't really give a damn about the legislation. They're not going to give us our bill. But what we can do is we can get our sisters and brothers on the streets of Washington saying that we're gay. We're proud, we're strong, and this year is the year.
I've seen in the short time that I've lived in Washington, D.C., the incredible number of protest marches. I've learned that to have a really significant one, it has to be incredibly well done, incredibly massive.
For a lot of people in a lot of places in this country, a march is not a reality for them. North Carolina is a real oppressive state. I think it's real important for us to celebrate our power as gay people and lesbians together, to actually get on the national media, make it into Time magazine. And those people in Wilmington, North Carolina will see that.
I represent the Southern Vermont Lesbian Gay Men's Coalition and the 4,000 Sisters from Brattleboro, Vermont. Brattleboro area has a population of 40,000. We can't march up Main Street without jeopardizing our jobs, our homes, custody of our children, etc. We can march in solidarity in Washington.
We simply will not see the kind of numbers that we talk about. It's nice to say, as some of the speakers have said, 500,000 people, 200,000 people, but saying it doesn't give them to us. We must show that we are a force to be reckoned with. I could not agree more. What I am afraid is that we will show that we are a force not to be reckoned with, and it will take us years to recover from that.
We have a terrific gay population in Woodstock. When we said to them, how about a national march in Washington, we got energy for the first time this year. And they can't hold out. We're the kind of rural population where a lot of those people don't even go down to New York City. We have a woman 73 years old who's never been to New York City, and she's never been to a march, and she told us to come down here and give them hell, you know? And we're hoping we'll get her down, but maybe we won't. Maybe we won't get thousands and thousands of gay people who would like to come. Maybe we won't get them for 10 or 20 years. But we have to get who we can. We have to get them now. We have to keep our energy up now.
I think there is something basically wrong with getting up on January the 1st and say, oh, what are we going to do this year? It is time that this movement considered itself serious enough to continue the rent past a one-year lease. Let's don't find ourselves in this situation anymore, running out of time, running out of hope, wishing, wanting, but can't do. That's ridiculous.
This is what the delegates decided.
Correspondent Bill Bogan.
There will be a march on Washington on October 14th, 1979. Not in 1980, as a sizable minority position recommended.
What we really want to do with this march is build a national consciousness around gay oppression. Freedom is never given to anybody, and unless we continue in our effort without putting our energy and our direction into a further action, a further effort, we will not get our freedom because nobody's going to give it to us.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Daniel Lucias. Our own Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, along with NPR's Maura Rankin, anchored the live radio broadcast of the October 14th, 1979 National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights. The broadcast itself was somewhat controversial, even by non-commercial radio standards. Homophobic media bias was alive and well, and rally MC Robin Tyler's demand for accurate press coverage ultimately went unheeded. As it is today, reality is defined by who controls the flow of information.
I want those television cameras out there to turn around and focus on one of the largest demonstrations in the history of this country. Look at that crowd! Focus on that crowd!
Anyone who was at the Gay and Lesbian March on Washington October 14th will tell you that it was a fantastic high, exceeding everyone's expectations in both quality and quantity.
Correspondent David Myers.
The only disappointment was the distorted numbers games played by the traditional media, who quoted the National Park Police crowd estimates and the National Park Police personnel who made those estimates.
What disturbed me was to pick up a Washington Post and see 25,000, and pick up a New York Times and see 75,000, and listen to the news, the local news, that said 125,000. I think we have to teach straight people how to count.
The official estimate of the Parks Police for the March on Washington crowd was 25,000 people. The same police estimated that 175,000 people attended the Pope's Mass on the other side of the Washington Monument a week earlier, October 8th. The District of Columbia police estimate was somewhat better, 75,000. During the rally, one speaker quoted the park's police estimate as 250,000.
The official police estimate of the crowd in the march is 250,000, a quarter of a million.
This figure apparently resulted when one march person overheard a park's police officer saying, quotes, there must be 250,000 gets out there.
Being there yesterday, I got there about 9:30 or 10, I got an instant high. The people that were already there at 10 was what I expected the whole crowd to be. Mm-hmm. At 12, it was like Zoomland. It was beautiful. It was marvelous.
The official March on Washington committee estimate was 125,000 people, obtained by a point count system. That is, by someone standing at one point and estimating the number of people per row and the number of rows marching by.
As far as the local media was concerned, we got what we usually get, which is not enough, but something.
I went to the Washington Post offices and asked about their use of the 25,000 estimate, and they explained that in order to avoid biased estimating of crowds, their policy was to only quote the objective Parks police estimates, as they use a scientific, objective, sophisticated grid system. I called the National Parks Police in order to find out more about this sophisticated grid system.
It's great to know that we have outdrawn the Pope!
It is interesting to compare the National Parks Police estimates of the March crowd and the Pope's crowd and how they were obtained. I talked to two Parks employees working in the Washington Monument, which overlooks the sites of the two crowds. They both claim that the gay March crowd was at least the same size as the Pope's crowd and possibly larger. I called Major Jim Lindsay and asked him how the Parks Police obtained their estimates of both the Pope's and the March on Washington crowds. He explained that the Pope's crowd was estimated by dividing one section of the crowd, an area about 570 feet on a side, into four parts and using an aerial photo to count the number of people in one of those four sections. They then estimated a population density for that area and extrapolated that density, which was taken from the densest part of the crowd, to the entire area occupied by the crowd. What that amounts to is an assumption that the Pope's crowd was uniformly dense, when their basis for estimate, in fact, came from the densest part of the crowd. I asked Major Lindsay if he had a grid area marked off in our crowd or if he made an estimate from photographs. He admitted that there were no measured grids and that there wasn't time to use photographs in preparing the estimates. So, in effect, a very crude and simplistic grid system was used to estimate the Pope's crowd, and no grid system at all was used to estimate the March crowd.
I, for one, was very angry over the Park Police reports yesterday. Los Angeles, California, that city, sent over 3,000 people here. Texas sent almost 10,000 people here. That was 13,000 people walking within two delegations. And so for somebody to turn around and say 25,000 people.
When I asked Major Lindsay if he was aware that the March Committee's estimate was 125,000 people, he disputed the figure by claiming that such a crowd would have meant that each person in that area would have only an average of 6 square feet to stand in. Judging from that crowd of well-packed, exuberant people, I would say that we had less than that amount of space for each person.
There's a lot of hugging and holding around here. It's a beautiful sight.
As far as national media was concerned, I think most people point out the fact that Time and Newsweek did not cover it.
I think it's real important for us to celebrate our power as gay people and lesbians together, to actually get on the national media, make it into Time magazine, and those people in Wilmington, North Carolina will see that.
And of course we're disappointed and we're a little bit angry, but since Newsweek in particular is owned by the Post, and the Post is notoriously bad on gay things, that's probably to be expected.
I've reached the point where I see this as really deliberately malicious. Gay crowds are consistently counted this way. I feel that there's a reason for it, and the reason is that the United States government does not wish for the data about the strength of the homosexual community in this country to go overseas truthfully. It doesn't want it going out to the straight community that way. It keeps trying to pretend that we are not here.
The people that were there were people that worked hard. They wanted to be there.
If I have to walk on my hands to Washington, I'm going to be there.
They knew their purposes for being there, to show the straight community that we do have a purpose. We belong in this world.
Look at us, America. You know us. You see us in your offices. You see us in your schools, in your churches, in your government. We are some of your best friends.
This is a really serious political movement. And these numbers games that they were playing with us is just indicative of gay oppression.
You know us, America. You are going to have to deal with us in the 80s, America.
America, America, God send his grace on thee.
There are some new organizations forming in Washington, probably as an indirect, if not direct, outcome of the march. Howard University, a predominantly black university, now has a gay student organization. Catholic University, of all places, is trying to form a gay organization. This could do a lot to politics in Washington eventually, I think, if those groups are strong. But as far as this particular march is concerned, there have been some lasting effects, I think. One of the most visible was that the lines at the Gay Men's VD Clinic have been quite long since the march, and apparently, according to the people who run the clinic, Washingtonians were not as standoffish as some of the leadership thought they might be.
They welcomed the people who came into town
with open everything.
The real irony of the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights was that it both fulfilled and fell short of everyone's expectations. Those who warned that the age of apathy could not be overcome were surprised by the thousands of people who came from all over the country. Those who imagined that the march's success would advance the lesbian and gay liberation movement to a position of real power were surprised to discover that the impact of any event is determined by the significance granted it by the mass media. If a tree falls in the forest with no one to hear, does it make a sound?
This program was produced by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell. Our field reporters included Bruce Pennington, Amy Sands, Jock Church, Art Ayrton, David Winyard, Hetty Swanson, David Myers, Bill Bogan, and Joan Sprague.
You've been listening to excerpts from an hour-long documentary about the 1979 National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights. You've heard some of the interesting facts and figures, some useful political parallels. To hear the true spirit of the march, the times, and the experience of the community, you can stream the complete program online wherever you prefer to listen on October 31st. Consider it a holiday treat. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Melanie Keller and David Hunt, and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondents were led by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell. You heard music by Supertramp, Kai Winding, and Margie Adam. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Daniel Wasillas. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on CHSR, Fredericton, New Brunswick, KTWH, Two Harbors, Minnesota, WELT Fort Wayne, Indiana, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
Life is better in the city. I like the way it don't know me.
The second Friday nights in the Recital Hall concert will be Cassador on November 22nd at 8 p.m. These shows at the Isabel are licensed and all ages, and tickets sell out fast. Get yours today. Check out queensu.ca/theisabel for details.
It speaks to me. The words she gives me, they're all empty.
CFRC from Kingston, Ontario. Your volunteer program can